From Cortland, New York, America's smallest small city, it's the Nerd Bomber Podcast, featuring the best news, entertainment, and related discussion that pop culture has to offer. And now, your hosts and experts in anti-social media, Just Jamie and your friend Claude! Ladies, gentlemen, millennials, welcome to the Nerd Bomber Podcast. I am your friend Claude, here for the first time in a very, very long time with...
Just... Jamie.
And it has indeed been quite a while since we have done an entertainment program for your ears. But we're back in a different year. Well into one.
It's 2021 now.
So things have happened since Christmas of 2020. Well, I think it's fair to say that in that time, we've all had our fair share of ups and downs and personal experiences. But Jamie, to get us started, why don't you catch us up on what some of yours have been?
Well, I mean, there's some things that I've engaged with recently that... I had started engaging with some of this stuff before when we were recording remote episodes. The first one I'll talk about is on the Shudder streaming app, and it's The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs. Hey, everybody, have you heard the news? Joe Bob is back in town. He's over at the drive-in, hanging around, watching crazy movies, so come on down to Joe Bob's Last Drive-In Show. So, anybody who knows me knows I'm a big fan of Joe Bob Briggs. His real name is John Bloom, not to break kayfabe, but that just happens to be the case.
Wait, that's not his name? That's not his real name?
No, I'm sorry. Joe Bob Briggs was a character he created to do drive-in movie reviews in Texas for a newspaper. And he was like the only guy doing it, and so he created this like redneck character. He's not that far away from the character in real life, but nevertheless, it is kind of a fictitious guy. Anyway, so Joe Bob Briggs, what I know him from childhood or more sort of adolescence than when I was a teen, was hosting Monster Vision on TNT.
Right.
And he had a lot of stuff going on. He did, I think it was just Joe Bob's Drive-In for TCM. And there's a lot more episodes of that than there is of Monster Vision. But Monster Vision is what really sort of gave him his cult fame, I guess.
Yeah, that's where I first heard of him.
Yeah, of course. And that's where most everybody knows him from. So anyway, he does a movie. He's kind of an old school horror movie host. It's not like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 situation. He doesn't riff on the movies as they play. He intros the movie. He usually goes on some kind of a rant that's connected to, you know, something that's happening in modern pop culture. Makes a bunch of jokes. He's known for doing his drive-in totals, which includes like a boob count and how many, you know, heads roll and arms roll and... If anybody gets in a fight, it's always foo. If they get in a fight with chainsaws, it's chainsaw foo, etc. And then they come out of breaks and he'll, you know, rant a little, or he'll talk about behind the scenes information, production notes, you know, this, you see this actor, he did these other things, the director did this and that, etc., etc. It goes and goes and goes. He's encyclopedic in terms of his like deep knowledge of this kind of like cult movie stuff. Anyway, toward the end of 2019, he got a new show on the Shudder app called The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs. Originally, it was just supposed to be a 24-hour marathon that was kind of like a send-off to his movie hosting career.
Oh.
But it broke the app. It got so much attention and so much traffic that Shudder decided to do a whole series. So...
Damn.
So I wasn't watching it as this happened. The first season of the series was toward the end of 2019. And the second season was into 2020 after the pandemic had technically started. So at that time, I'm like, all right, there's nothing else to do. I'm going to get the Shudder app. It's pretty cheap. And so I was able to catch up on most of that marathon, the first season, and then the second season as it was happening. And then I watched the third season as it happened. He usually does holiday specials for Thanksgiving, Christmas, Halloween. He even did one for Valentine's Day this past year. So there was a lot of material to catch up on. It's tricky because it's kind of the nature of doing these movie shows. Mystery Science Theater runs into this too, where sometimes an episode they did gets lost to time because of licensing issues.
Oh, right.
So like if you sit, so on Shudder, it has like the original marathon, but it's not all 24 hours of it. There's things that have been sort of chopped away from it. Nevertheless, there's a lot there. There's a couple seasons worth of shows. There's all the specials. So a big chunk of my 2020 was sort of catching up on all this material and reacquainting myself with Joe Bob Briggs. And that's been like a big part of what I've been into over the past, you know, 18 months or so. One of the reasons for that is that another sort of quirk of the last drive-in show on Shudder is that it's pretty much exclusively horror.
Yeah.
And in the old days with Monster Vision, even though it was called Monster Vision, there was a pretty wide horizon of movies. Like they would have sci-fi, they have other genre pictures. Even once in a while, like a regular drama or a comedy or something like that, it would happen from time to time. So I think that's a little bit of a detriment to the current show, where you only get these sort of cult horror movies, and some of them are pretty hard to...
Yeah.
Because either, you know, there's some that are literally shot on VHS camcorder, and they sort of make a theme about it so it's fun and everything, but some of them are kind of hard watches, not necessarily because of the violence or the gore, but just because it's nothing budgets. Yeah. But the overall sort of concept of the show always makes it worth it to me. But it would be nice to see like a more varied... offering in terms of the genre and the style and the type of movie that they have.
Right.
So I'm all for it. I recommend it to everybody. I think it's great.
Yeah. Keeping the horror host tradition alive.
Exactly. Him and Sven Gulli, they're like the only ones.
That's true. Yeah. Well, normally at this point in our ancient format, we'd be going into a segment called 3-2-1 Pop, where we break down the top three headlines of current pop culture. However, we thought we'd discuss the last 18 pandemic-ridden months, but in a way that you don't really hear that often, we're doing it through the prism of some of the more entertaining and positive aspects of that period. So, to kick us off, Jamie, what do you got?
So, one big sort of like positive moment for me was Star Wars. Really? In general. Yes.
Star Wars, the umbrella term.
The umbrella term. Okay. And this is thanks to two things. One that is current to the pandemic timeline, and that is The Mandalorian Show. The second season came out, you know, at once we were into the pandemic, into COVID times.
That's right. I forget.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that, everybody knows what happens at the end of that season at this point. The return of, spoiler, Luke Skywalker.
Hey!
It was a great moment and got me all warm and fuzzy about Star Wars. Now, there's kind of like a tandem thing happening with me because I always liked the Clone Wars show, but I'd fallen behind on it before it ended, and then Disney put out a couple new seasons a year or two ago.
Right.
Well, I guess 2 or 3 years ago now. And so I finally finished that up, and that show finishes so strong, and The Mandalorian was so good that my feelings about Star Wars were turned around 180 degrees from where I was, you know, kind of by the end of the sequel trilogy.
Yeah.
So I was really happy to sort of feel that way about the franchise again. And it was kind of almost like a pop culture relief in a way.
Hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of people have had a similar experience where like Star Wars, the traditional Star Wars movie going experience has become pretty negatively viewed, has left a pretty bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. But the Star Wars TV offerings tend to be a lot more reliable and high quality, and it's the shows you mentioned, and I think even Rebels was pretty well received.
Yeah, I've started Rebels and not all the way through it, but it is also a lot better than I expected.
Yeah.
I think the best of Clone Wars so far is better than what I've seen in Rebels, but I haven't finished it yet, so I don't want to speak unfairly about Rebels. The other thing about The Mandalorian that is doing interestingly, and I don't know that anybody really saw this coming, is that it seems to be like, it's like the central node. It's like the nexus point of all these sort of different Star Wars things that I think, like, so historically speaking, especially with the cartoon series, it's always like, well, this happened between this movie and that movie, and you just kind of accept it and you move on.
Right.
But The Mandalorian is really tying these things together with the movies in a more direct way that doesn't feel extremely forced.
Yeah.
So they have Ahsoka show up from the series, but then they have Luke Skywalker from the film franchise, that is. And so, yeah, like I said, I don't know if anybody saw that coming, but The Mandalorian is serving as this sort of central point through which all of these seemingly disparate, even though we know that it's all the same timeline technically, but this is making it make more sense a little bit to me.
Yeah.
And makes it feel less forced. Because what happens is you watch the Clone Wars, and by the end of that series, it becomes very clear that the focus of the show is Ahsoka.
Right.
And that's supposed to take place before the original trilogy.
And she's Darth Vader's apprentice?
Yes, yeah. Yes. She's Anakin's apprentice, yep. And she leaves the Jedi Order, and, you know, a bunch of stuff happens. She fights Darth Maul at the end. It's very dramatic. But then, of course, because this show was made after the original trilogy, it's not like this character ever shows up or is mentioned in
right.
Star Wars or The Empire Strikes Back or The Return of the Jedi. So it's kind of like this fun idea, but it's like she's not really there, so it feels hollow.
You have to, like, imagine it.
Yes, yeah. Well, she must have been, I don't know, the other side of the room. Right. The camera didn't see her. So, but The Mandalorian, like I said, is kind of bringing all these people into the same, on the same plane. So you have Ahsoka, you have Luke. That does a lot. Even though they're in different episodes, having them appear in the same, on the same show, in the same, on the same layer, so to speak, really does a lot to tie everything together for me.
Yeah, it's well, I think you made the analogy of like the hub.
Yep.
Where it's like all these spokes now are joined in the middle. But I feel like it's, for me, it's also almost like lifting a gate that used to exist between, you know, these different incarnations. Like you would have to like compartmentalize them almost in your brain.
Absolutely.
And now you kind of don't. They're kind of intermingling in a way that actually makes sense, and you don't have to, like, your own imagination doesn't have to do the heavy lifting anymore.
Right.
It's right there for you to see.
And there's something to be said for that. I don't need everything to sort of spoon feed me every bit of lore and information. But I think that because Star Wars wants to be this continuous, well, continuity, not to be redundant, but they want this solid continuity, and that's what they've been trying to build, but this really solidifies it. So
yeah, I think you're right. And then recently Disney Plus put up the part two of the Making of the Mandalorian special. Now we're seeing like the actual behind the scenes of Mark Hamill's involvement in the Luke Skywalker appearance and stuff.
Yeah,
where there was, it, until recently, it was kind of just like rumors and speculation about exactly what he did, and now you can see what the involvement was and, you know, get the fuller picture.
There's a whole nother level of secrecy to that.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of stuff, not to kind of go off on a tangent, but there's a lot of stuff coming on film. It's kind of like it's secret, but we know it's coming.
Right.
Like with the new Spider-Man movie, everybody expects to see Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield. We know we're getting Doc Ock. We know we're getting this mix of the previous franchises. And we're going to get the same thing over at the DC end with the Flash movie. And now we've got Michael Keaton returning as Bruce Wayne / Batman,
exactly,
along with Ben Affleck. And so even though, like, I guess DC is being forward about it now because Michael Keaton is straight up saying things in interviews.
Yeah, he's making the rounds, yeah.
But on the Spider-Man side, it's still, like, technically a secret, even though we all kind of know. But Mandalorian, like, I had no inkling.
Yeah, they wrapped it right up.
Even as that scene started to build, it took me a second.
Yeah.
And even before they even, like, we got one X-Wing. I was like, oh, it's going to be Wedge Antilles.
Right.
He's going to have his big moment. But it was Luke fucking Skywalker. And I did not see that coming. And it took me a while until I was literally watching the episode. And that just does not happen very often these days.
No, they pulled off something pretty massive there. Kind of similarly to when the original trilogy was being made and they would throw off even people in the cast with fake production titles and fake scripts and stuff just to keep secrecy. They gave the cast for this production art that showed kind of a more obscure Jedi character named Plo Koon as the one who comes.
Right.
The same exact body and everything, but it's this guy's head. So they all thought it was this Plo Koon guy until basically Mark Hamill comes on the set.
So it was well done. It reminds me of a couple other things for me personally. Like, going back a couple years, for most people are probably not going to have the same amount of nostalgia value on something like this. But because Jurassic Park is my favorite movie of all time, okay? So in Jurassic World, this big Indominus Rex or whatever, dinosaurs, you know, wreaking havoc.
Yep.
So they decide they're going to, well, open paddock number whatever it is. And they don't really show what it is. But Bryce Dallas Howard's character runs over with a flare. Hmm. And it's the T-Rex from the first movie. It's the exact same one, colloquially known as Roberta, by the way. And
right.
and so it's like the T-Rex fight, and she gets to fight the Indominus. Like, for me, that was like a big deal, like chills, that type of thing. And then since The Mandalorian, another moment that was like that for me was in WandaVision. Hmm. And that was when Evan Peters shows up.
Oh, yeah.
As, you know, in air quotes, Quicksilver.
Right.
I did not see that coming. Like, are they going there? Like, for a second, I thought they were literally going, like, this is how X-Men come into the MCU. Mm. They didn't go that way with it, and that's totally fine. WandaVision was amazing. But those were two moments that remind me of the Luke thing, where it's just, like, two of these moments that I did not see coming.
Yeah. Yeah, that one was almost, yeah. I can't remember which. The Mandalorian happened first.
The Mandalorian
before
definitely happened.
Yeah,
it happened before WandaVision.
So
they
were clearly like setting you up for that, and then gave you the big swerve.
The dinosaur thing happened a few years before, but you didn't have to like hide an actor.
Right. Yeah. I can appreciate the way the WandaVision handled that. It kind of annoyed you if you wanted that to be the case, but it was done in an entertaining way.
Yeah, it didn't.
You know, clever.
There was so much else going on with the show that it was strong enough where the fact that it was just like, we're going to make a boner joke. It didn't. I was not bothered by that. It didn't really it didn't affect my enjoyment of the show.
Surprisingly, also from Disney.
Yeah. Disney TV is on a hot streak right now. It's kind of amazing.
Right.
You know, speaking of WandaVision, I mean, I could actually talk about that for a second because it's another Disney show. So Disney scripted TV is kind of on a hot streak right now. Coming off The Mandalorian, they immediately gave us 1, 2, 3 Marvel MCU series.
Yeah.
They started with WandaVision. Their process was supposed to start with Captain America. How was it titled? Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
When you watch the two shows, you can see why that's the case. Falcon and the Winter Soldier is very classically MCU. It's kind of safer. The characters are very familiar. Their relationships are very familiar. It's a well-done show. It was very well acted. I like the moment at the end where Sam Wilson becomes Captain America. I think there was some great stuff in that show. But it is a safer show, and you can see why they would have wanted to introduce the audience to their TV properties with something that felt familiar.
Yeah, definitely.
The pandemic affected things, so WandaVision comes out first. Right away, WandaVision devotes, I think, two full episodes, maybe three full episodes, to just being homages to old school sitcoms. Literally in black and white, they just give you these weird sort of sinister moments that give you the inkling that something else is going on. And then, of course, you know, once they get into the season a little bit, you see more and more of it, and you get more of what's going on outside of this bubble, what's going on inside of it, et cetera, et cetera. It was a super weird show. And really well done. But again, the same way that I could see why the other show was supposed to go first, because it felt very MCU style, very safe, very familiar, this one deviates from that a lot more.
Yeah.
I think to great effect. I really liked WandaVision. I even, you know, I heard a lot of people kind of like, they were having issues kind of waiting for the show to get going as they sat through these homage sections. But I was 100% on board. Because for the most part, I trust the MCU to make good decisions. And like, I'm going to sit and watch this. First of all, what was amazing to me is those first couple episodes really work as sitcoms.
Yeah.
They work as episodes of sitcoms you would watch from that period of time.
Right.
Which was really hard to pull off. And secondly, I know there's something more coming. So even if they're not showing it on screen, I'm sort of melding that into it, maybe in my own psyche, I guess.
Yeah.
So it kind of adds to the depth of the show because I know there's more coming.
Well, I read that at least on the first one or two episodes, they even shot it in front of an actual audience.
That's so great.
Because apparently Paul Bettany was like super nervous to perform in that way. And I guess that was a new experience for him. But I mean, that just shows you the length, I guess, that they went to make it authentic, and also how much it worked in that setting. And right. that was a gimmick that I'm a classic TV junkie as it is. So,
yeah.
I mean, I was definitely on board for as much of that as they wanted to give me.
The one thing that I really wanted to see, and I was hoping that they would be ballsy enough to go there, would be an animated episode. A Flintstones, Simpsons, yeah. Family Guy, maybe not Family Guy in terms of the vibe, but... you know, animated sitcom episode, yeah. But they didn't quite go there. It would have been cool. I can't blame them for not.
Right.
I thought, like, if they really want to go deep into this multiverse stuff, they'll do it. And actually, I'm kind of wondering the same thing about, like, the Spider-Man movie. I'm like, if they really got the guts, yeah. Let's see a little bit of animation.
Right.
It just has to be one. It doesn't have to be something that's throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
One little thing, just a hint. I think that would be amazing. I have my doubts, but I'm just throwing it out there for anybody who might want to, like, anybody who has influence over such things, I'll bill you later.
Yeah, you're right. I hadn't even really considered it, but I guess in order to truly tie everything together, they would have to include something from Into the Spider-Verse. So.
Right, yeah. And I have, like I said, I have my doubts, but I think it would be cool.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. And so WandaVision started off the MCU television sort of experience. They went to Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which I already talked about a little bit. And then they went to Loki. And I wasn't super excited about this show, to be honest with you, because I'm not super excited about the character of Loki. It's a little bit mystifying to me that as a character he has taken off in terms of his recognition and how much people love him.
Right.
You know, he was just a villain to me, and then he became this like lovable loser almost, and this, you know,
yep.
It's like, oh, it's always mischief with Loki. Well, he killed millions of people, but you know, hey, he's awful silly and handsome.
Yeah.
But I liked it a lot more than I expected to. I was totally on board for the whole series. Owen Wilson was great. There was some really interesting stuff happening. People's online predictions were not right for WandaVision because it was Mephisto. That was not the case. But people with Loki, spoiler alert, it was all Kang,
right.
The Conqueror. And that's kind of what it ends up being. There's a little bit of variance there because there's different versions of Kangs in different realities. And they're kind of playing with that a little bit. But it's pretty clear that's where they're going with it. And what was also interesting about Loki is it's the of the three, it's the show that definitely sort of like cuts out without finishing the story.
Mm.
It leads into another season way more obviously than the other shows do. If the other shows didn't come back, you'd say like, okay, they're going to finish these story arcs in the movies. Like mm-hmm. You kind of get how that could work. The Loki show really seems like it has to come back as a show to finish up. And I think that's in the cards. I think that's what they plan on doing. But yeah, just to go back to my original thought, I liked it a lot more than I expected to, because I wasn't super hyped for it in the first place.
Right. From what I've seen online, there is a season two expected, but
right,
literally that's the only information that exists.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it's if and when it does, it's probably pretty far off after several of their next planned shows.
Right.
So, but I don't know a lot about what's coming up, but I know that Moon Knight is among them, and I'm pretty excited about that.
So, a couple weeks ago, I sent you a picture of the leaked image of the costume.
Yeah.
I didn't really get your reaction to that at the time. So, what are you thinking about it? I know you're kind of a Moon Knight fan. I'm a little bit neutral on the character, so.
Yeah, like, I don't know. It's hard, you know. I've been guilty in the past, certainly, of jumping to, not a fully formed opinion, but a judgment based on just one picture.
I'm enabling it by even, like, asking right now.
But, I mean, and I'm not... The reaction I saw to that picture online was really positive. Like, oh my God, it's actually a comic-accurate costume. I don't feel like it is. But I don't feel like it's, like, horrible or unrecognizable. It doesn't make me go, oh man, I'm even more excited, but it doesn't turn me off.
I don't always trust the whole, when the fandom starts screaming comic-accurate.
Yeah.
Because, like, you... sometimes they just like it, even if it's not, and then they claim it's comic accurate.
Right.
Like the one time, and me and you could probably debate this and argue about this a little bit, because I know that you were a fan of it. Spider-Man's original costume in the MCU. I mean, everybody was screaming about how great it was and how what a great homage to the comics it was. And to me, it's nowhere near the most comic accurate Spider-Man costume on film. It's got these weird black graphics on it, and it never looked... I don't mind it. I don't dislike it at all. But to me, it was never comic accurate, and I just don't know where that groundswell came from. It's like, if you like it, you can just like it. You don't have to, like... it doesn't have to live up to any standard.
For me, it's all about the head.
Okay, all right. It's got, definitely got Steve Ditko eyes.
It's the most comic book-looking face, mask, head that I've seen, and that sells the rest of it for me. It is disappointing that they have these random like black parts on it, like you said. That
right.
I guess it ties in with the fact that they it's created by Stark Technology and whatever.
Yeah.
Which gets kind of...
Don't get me started on that.
Yeah,
that's
a rabbit hole.
Because they're immediately going to, like, now he's iron spider suits right. all the time. Like, immediately they got away from this thing that got such a positive reaction. No, I don't think anybody dislikes it, but I could go off on sort of like, why is Spider-Man so connected to Stark, and why are they doing this? And then,
right.
I'm not going to do that right now. Maybe someday.
Sometimes being excited about the look of a character is really dependent on like only one or two elements being nailed.
Sure.
And I mean, I guess you could make that argument about a lot of things that have gotten over big with people and been really popular. I mean, you could say that going back to, I guess, like the Michael Keaton Batmans. Like, certainly that's not comic accurate.
No.
But for what it is, it worked so well. It was almost like a case of like the key elements were done well, but then it gave you stuff you didn't know you wanted.
Yeah.
It also worked.
I mean, my favorite Batman costume in any movie is Batman Returns.
Right.
And that's a far away from being comic accurate. It has
sure.
this weird abdominal armor going on and, you know, of course, like the all black with the bright yellow. That didn't really happen in the comics.
No.
But yeah, so I totally agree with you there. Another example, too, is some things I think get overlooked. So you're a big fan. I always talk about the Captain America costumes in the movies.
Yeah.
You're a big fan of the original Avengers costume.
Right.
Well, to me, I've heard you say
it's
that.
It's the best of what they gave us. That's what
know.
I will say.
I don't know about that.
I'm actually, if you want to go real, I'll go to the 1990 movie.
I mean, you're
rubber
not wrong.
Ears and all.
You're not wrong. You're talking comic accurate. You're not wrong at all. I think that original like Captain America costume looks a little bit hokey on screen because it's weirdly... like tight, and it just doesn't quite fit with sort of this very textury look of everything else.
Yeah.
And I know like we could go down a hole on like textured costumes too.
Right.
You know, my favorite Captain America costume is from one of the more forgotten MCU movies, Avengers Age of Ultron. I think that is an homage to the original costume while still giving it a cooler look, something that looks better on Chris Evans on film.
Yeah.
So I think there's some balance there. There's kind of balancing what looks good on film, what looks good on the actor,
mm-hmm.
what looks good when you're moving around. Because that's the problem with something like that original Captain America movie you're talking about, actually, from the 90s. It looks great, but as soon as he starts moving his arm or anything, you can see the rubber just
right.
you know, creasing and bending and bunching, and that you know things kind of start to fall apart there. Right. It's like everybody says, well, Michael Keaton couldn't turn his head.
Yep.
Well, he could turn his head, but if he did, you know, the hole would stretch over his neck, and it would bunch up over, and, you know, his eye would disappear behind the rubber. So that's kind of part of the issue, where it has to look good and be functional on screen. And they... overdo the CGI now just with costuming.
Yeah, oh
it's
yeah.
It's like, some, you know, he's wearing a costume and they still CGI over the top of it. I don't know why that's always necessary. I get it maybe with like Iron Man, but anyway, that's a whole tangent. Again, we haven't recorded in a while, and you can tell because there's all these tangents I want to go down, and I keep pulling the brakes on it. Please go ahead.
Along the costume theme and bringing it back to, circling back to the topic of Moon Knight, I still only seen that one picture, and I don't, you know, I can't really... I think you said you were neutral on the character. I'm neutral on what I'm seeing for the show, but I'm not turned off by any means.
Right.
And I'm excited conceptually. And I mean, I was a little... Everybody... I mean, this goes back again to like the Michael Keaton era and probably even before, where casting announcements for these kinds of things
sure.
are always very polarizing. And for me, I was pretty turned off that they cast Oscar Isaac. Only because like he's another, I'm big on when you're doing superheroes, especially superheroes that are kind of new to the TV or live action or you know having a series or a movie. I'm big on kind of having an unknown or a person that like you can really associate mainly with this role. And Oscar Isaac at this point is very recognizable from many, many other things, not least of which is also under the Disney umbrella, the Star Wars sequel trilogy. And also he just, you know, it's known that he's a shorter guy and like they've released footage of him training for it and he looks like he's taking it very seriously. And, you know, I mean, it shouldn't ultimately be an issue, but it's just something that initially made me kind of like, oh, I kind of wish they did something different. But again, time will tell.
Yeah, I'm sure. Again, goes to Michael Keaton. A lot of that was the exactly. big thing. Michael Keaton's a smaller, not a small guy, but you know, he's not sort of like hulking like Batman is.
Yeah.
Well, Oscar Isaac is a tough one too because he's so recognizable. Not only just because of the other Disney property that he's in Star Wars, but he was already in a Marvel movie.
Right.
He played Apocalypse of all things.
Exactly.
That was probably much worse casting, and it might not have all been his
that
fault.
That did not go over well.
That movie had its own problems. I won't get into now. But also, he's got this huge tentpole movie coming out later this year. You know, he's going to be Leo Atreides in Dune.
Right.
I mean, I could go off about Dune because it's the thing I'm looking forward to the most in all of 2021. It's my favorite book. I can't wait. The trailer got me all teary. But that's kind of like a big deal. So, and that's kind of, you see him a lot in that context right now.
Yeah.
So then to have people shift gears and be like, and here he is in Moon Knight, a thing you've never heard of. Most people have never heard of Moon Knight. And that's the thing with, like, I know of Moon Knight, but I don't have any special nostalgia for it.
Yeah.
In some ways, it's easier to go into it that way because I trust MCU and they can give me something that's good and I'll be okay with it. If they make alterations to how the comic book character is, I won't know.
Yeah, you don't have to put all these expectations on it right. or whatever. But also, I think that kind of reinforces my point is in Oscar Isaac's case, it's not just, hey, I know him from this. It's like simultaneously other things happening at the same time.
Yeah, so yeah. It's, and you don't see that in Marvel very often. You don't see like you don't always see the sort of like the current hot commodity showing up.
Yeah.
Concurrently with three or four other things. It kind of happened with Robert Downey Jr., but only after he had started. Like, you know, his career was kind of, I don't want to say faltering, but he was just kind of like there.
Mm-hmm.
And then he became Tony Stark and became known as that character. And then Sherlock came out and then whatever.
Right.
But it didn't kind of happen. He wasn't already sort of at the peak and then show up in the movies.
Yeah.
So I think that's the difference. Not some people in the MCU were recognizable before they came. Some of them were not. But none of them sort of, I shouldn't say none, but very few of them are coming from this sort of zenith of presence
yeah.
in other pop culture.
And they're not coming from other, like, comic book or superhero roles.
Right.
I mean,
right,
obviously,
right.
Scarlett Johansson was a huge star and actress before she played Black Widow, but she wasn't really known for any other type of comic book role,
right?
Which it allowed you to buy in. That was, I mean, it's kind of a nitpick at this point, but at the time, you know, Chris Evans was one of these kind of annoyances for me because of him playing Johnny Storm in both of the earlier Fantastic Four movies,
right?
Which I still maintain is the much better casting for him. I never was able to fully buy him as Steve Rogers, and it just, he always seemed a little mismatched for the role of Captain America to me.
As a guy, he's way too precocious.
Yeah. It just doesn't play. I just feel like that character doesn't play to his natural strengths as an actor, as a personality. I mean, he pulls it off fine. You know, he's a good actor, and, you know, he fits the part physically, I suppose. But, like, there's just something off for me, and I think it just comes from the fact that I saw him in a much more fitting role as, like, the cocky, you know, young, arrogant
high school jock and not another teen movie.
That's exactly. And that's exactly kind of what Johnny Storm was.
Yeah, it's, you
know?
True.
And you don't want to be typecast, but, I mean, I don't know. It's hard. It's superheroes require a suspension of disbelief that a lot of other kinds of roles don't really need.
Right, right, right. So to kind of, like, turn right all of a sudden awful drastically – one other thing that I had to talk about in terms of my pandemic pop culture experience was The Color Out of Space.
We're living a dream.
Maybe it is a dream.
Then everything just blew up.
This was a movie that came out on Shudder. It was technically released in January of 2020, but I didn't watch it until after the pandemic was well underway.
Right.
And so Color Out of Space is based on a H.P. Lovecraft book. It was directed by Richard Stanley, and this is like his first film since The Island of Dr. Moreau in the 90s. Yeah. And it stars Nicolas Cage, and it's also got Julie Richardson. Tommy Chong is in it, actually, in a really good part for him. Small, but really well done. It's excellent. It's one of the more... It's not accurate to the Color Out of Space story itself, but it's one of the more successful attempts at capturing what an H.P. Lovecraft story is.
Which is not a small feat.
It's not, because it's been infamously hard to do. H.P. Lovecraft, I always say, like, he's not a good writer, per se, but he has really cool, unique ideas.
Right.
And so he captures you with that. But the thing about, like, his style of horror and his monsters and his stories is that most of the time, 90% of a story, you don't see the monster. You don't know what the monster is. You don't know what the monster wants, because that's what cosmic horror is. That's what he mostly wrote, was cosmic horror. It was forces beyond our comprehension, forces beyond what we could understand. And the evil chaos that they desired was, you know, not tangible.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, not only did you not understand their motivations, you don't even understand what the monster is, what it looks like, how to describe it. And so this movie did a really good job of capturing that part of what H.P. Lovecraft is.
Hmm.
You do kind of like see physical transformation and monster stuff happen, and parts of it are way more gory than I expected, way more body horror, John Carpenter's The Thing type of stuff happening.
Right.
But a lot of it was just like the atmosphere and just like the main characters going crazy. And of course, Nick Cage can go crazy like no other. So, and he goes to some weird places to display that, but so The Color Out of Space, I thought was really, really cool. And Nick Cage is on this weird run of doing these like little indie genre movies.
Yeah.
He did Mandy a few years ago. I think that came out in 2018. And that was a really weird sort of like revenge horror, psychedelic, surrealist movie. And then he did The Color Out of Space, and he's got like a couple others now. There's just these super weird, lower budget, yes, but still really, really artistically pulled off, like genre movies.
Yeah.
And I love this kind of like what's happening in his career right now, and I hope he continues it. I don't ever need to see him in like a AAA big budget Hollywood blockbuster again. This stuff always for Nicolas Cage, because it suits his energy so well. So yeah, Color Out of Space I thought was great. It's not for everybody, but I really enjoyed it, and I had to mention it.
Well, you made a right turn before, so let's make a hard left.
All right.
But still sticking with kind of the central theme of positive elements of the pandemic. A lot of people used the time that they had in the initial quarantine period and away from their job to kind of focus on fitness and, you know, I guess in the early days of the pandemic, it seemed there was much more of an emphasis on the fact that your vulnerabilities are increased when you are out of shape, when you're kind of at a heavier weight. And a lot of people use the spare time to, like, you know, buy exercise equipment and work out at home, because obviously you couldn't go to a gym anymore.
Yep.
Initially, I did the opposite. And I think a lot of people did that too, where they were just shut-ins, just kind of didn't know what to expect and kind of just eating comfort food. And, you know, so I put on... actually, at the beginning of the pandemic was the last day of my gym was open. So I had just hit a year of consistent going to the gym, and then started 6 months solid of not anymore.
Yeah.
But I came out of that with a vengeance and have since been very focused on fitness. And to that end, there are, for me personally, there are several things coming up. Because the big 4-0 looms on the horizon within this within the coming months. And anytime I hit a milestone birthday like that, I tend to get very antsy about what do I have accomplished and what do I still need to do, and I want to hit this by this age and things like that. So one of those things is a long-term, I don't know if it's fully a dream, but it's a project I've had in the back burner that I really wanted to kind of flesh out. So, since I'm once again pursuing fitness, I wonder if you'd be interested in helping me achieve this goal of creating my own real-life 80s movie training montage.
What the fuck are you doing to me right now? This is not in the format.
No, it's not. But it is happening one way or another.
Oh, my God. All right. Okay.
And I'm not sure how much we've talked about it on the show before, but you have been basically a lifelong, fairly most of your adult life anyway, fitness enthusiast of various types.
Yes, this is true. I've even been a professional in the field, and I am currently one.
There you go. So to that end, let's let my quest meet your qualifications.
So just let me get this straight. Your fitness goal is not a competition of any type. It's not a goal. It's not a poundage. It's not a lifting accomplishment. The goal of your training is to complete a training montage.
That is essentially the goal, is to document my journey, not through some vlog or some boring Instagram reel or something, but to actually shoot, edit, and get into shape for the finished product of what you would see, in any classic 80s montage. I mean, I guess predominantly or like a Rocky movie.
Wow. To be clear, though, like the beginning of this montage has to be full of failure.
Oh, absolutely. And I plan for it to be. Because there, while I am, this is not my first rodeo with getting in shape, it is, it's the one where I plan to be the most thorough, where I'm coasting now on past experience and like just the limited knowledge that I've allowed myself to get to, you know, a certain level. But there are plenty of areas unexplored that I have little to no experience in that documenting will provide the initial fail shots. But it's great because you need, in order to make that payoff count, you got to have the struggle.
That's right. You need the before pictures. Wow. Okay. Yeah. So I'm just the director then, really. I mean, let's be clear about this.
A couple of hats, really, if you, depending on how deep you want to get it. Technical advisor is probably a really big one.
All right. Okay. Consultant. All right.
One of those areas is like, you know, more than weights that are more involved than dumbbells, basically. Uh-huh.
Right. Okay.
And I also did is I want to kind of bring this idea to the forefront when I'm still at a fairly heavy weight before I've made too much progress.
All right, yeah.
So
yeah.
I could still get that before shot, you know.
That's a very, like, that's a very confident statement.
Yes.
Like, I don't want to be too in shape for
exactly.
this.
Exactly. This is, well, I mean, you've seen, and this is obviously a very shoestring budget version, but, I mean, people have seen things like this done, even in things like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, man.
Rob McElhenney, I think is his name,
yep.
right?
Yep.
He purposely gained weight for, I don't know, at least a year.
To be clear, on the show even, he used to say all the time, he was cultivating mass.
Right.
And God damn it if he wasn't right.
Exactly. Yeah, it was a big joke until it wasn't.
That's right. Yeah. He showed up for that, like, I guess it was it their most recent season? The season before their most recent.
I think it was the one before the most recent.
And he finished this big dance number, and he's fucking jacked and ripped. Yeah. He's yoked.
Now, I have no illusions of getting to that level of fitness or to that low body fat. And let's be honest, he's on TRT and all these Hollywood guys are being assisted.
Yes.
I'm just doing what I can do. But I am confident that I can achieve something that is a stark contrast to where I'm starting.
All right. Okay. So I need to get out my schedule book, apparently. We'll have some updates in the next episode, exactly what we're going to do, maybe.
Yeah, keep people abreast of exactly where I'm at and how how serious I've taken it or achieved so far.
I have to say, you know, you were talking earlier about, you know, how a lot of people ran out and got equipment and everything. When my gym closed, I did immediately panic.
Yeah.
And I went out and I equipped my garage with bargain basement, Dick's clearance, and Walmart, you know, squat rack and barbell, and I got the basics, and I worked out exclusively on that equipment for over a year. I finally went back to a real gym probably this past June.
Yeah, so pretty recent.
Yeah. So I went, you know, a year and several months without stepping foot in a commercial gym of any kind. And I found that I had maintained, you know, certain levels of ability. So the thing that got me was I got into the strongman and powerlifting stuff. And so I did put on weight and, you know, I probably used that as too much of an excuse and got a little bit too heavy, but nevertheless, like I had this, you know, I'm doing powerlifting and strongman competitions.
Those are big guys.
So yeah, exactly. They're goddamn giants. Even at the recreational level, man, these dudes are huge. So then I had that plus the COVID.
Right.
So, but I didn't peak out, you know, like the 280 mark for me is about what I peaked out at. And some people that sounds like a big number, but on my frame, I think it looks, I do okay with that kind of weight. I want to drop some after I compete next time. But nevertheless, I had this sort of like double prong thing where it's like, I had already bulked myself up probably too big. And then the COVID hit, but nevertheless, my garage setup suited my needs and my goals until I just couldn't take it anymore and got, you know, you can only do the same thing so many times before you get bored with it. So,
right. So. Well, yeah, if you're always having to overcome additional hurdles on top of the task that you're, you know, of exercising itself, like it's going to burn you out.
The task is already a challenge.
Yeah.
And, like, you're overcoming these obstacles just to get to that.
Plus, you've seen what happens in all those Joe Bob horror movies in the dark like that.
That's exactly right. I don't trust the shadows.
And that brings us full circle. So yeah, stay tuned for the fitness updates, and hopefully we're building to an actual tangible piece of video that you'll either really be impressed by or cringe at harder than you've ever cringed in your life. But that'll do it for this return episode of the Nerd Bomber Podcast. I have been your friend Claude.
And I have been just Jamie.
Always remember, when life isn't fun, make fun your way of life. Until next time.
Later.
The Nerd Bomber Podcast is a Ghost Factory Internet production brought to you by the WHAM Network.